Welcome to Camera Ready and Able, the podcast that explores the intersection of media change and personal growth. I'm your host, Barbara Barna Able, and my calling is to help you tap into your superpowers to thrive on camera and in life, and to make an impact on the world. This episode is brought to you by the phrase, creativity is a transferable skill. Creativity is the ability to create, produce, or develop original work, theories, techniques, thoughts, and ways of seeing. Transferable skills are the abilities you take from job to job. I think it's often overlooked how important creativity is as a transferable skill. Here to discuss is BAFTA-nominated television director Ed Bazalgette, who exemplifies creativity as a transferable skill, having first found success as a musician, then editor, and now director and producer, including transitioning from unscripted to scripted television, which I'm here to inform you, if you work in TV, you know is no easy feat. Ed's directing credits include Doctor Who, Poldark, The Last Kingdom, including the offshoot movie Seven Kings Must Die for Netflix, and The Witcher. Ed and I first met when he was the lead guitarist for The Vapors on tour supporting their global hit Turning Japanese, and I've been a super fan ever since. So welcome to the podcast, Ed.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Very nice to be here.
Oh, thank you. So I know I actually foisted this topic onto you. Most people choose their topics, but I was like, Ed, will you come on and talk about this? Because I've been really curious about this ever since I really became aware of how you transitioned from music to, I think, going to film school, becoming an editor, starting to work, I think, in the documentary and factual space. And then one day, I think in 2015, I was watching the premiere episode of Poldark on PBS and like fell off my chair when you directed by Ed Bazalgette. I was like, this is amazing because this is not easy, but you proved that it's possible. And I think that it's actually very informative and inspiring to the people who listen to my podcast. So just diving in, what do you think are the most important skills for a director? Because it's both a leadership position and a creative job.
Ooh, God, that's diving in, isn't it? That's my second least favorite question of all time.
What's your most unfavorite question?
My most unfavorite question was we were sat down on a kind of on a panel with a load of other sort of really top brilliant drama directors about 5 years ago, and the interviewer just turned to me and said, Ed Bazalgette, tell me about the state of drama in the UK at the moment. And it's kind of like, could we just have a slightly more all-encompassing question, please? Open-ended. But this is good. What was the question? What are the most important skills?
It's like that you bring as a director. My point is because you've done multiple things.
Yeah, I think, wow, this is where a list would be handy. But I think that as I go around the track more and more times, I was going to say other words, but as you accumulate different experiences, that's a good way of saying it. I think that you definitely, I think there are the soft skills become more and more important, which is the last thing that I think a lot of people listening will want to hear. But I genuinely think it's the case. The soft skills, listening is so important. Being able to sort of hear different people's points of view, even though, you might look at it and think, well, okay, so he's saying listening is important, but his job is to tell people what to do. But I think so much of what we do is about bringing the best out of other people and having that sense of enablement and empathy and trying to gauge where people are at and hear what their interpretation of the material you're working on is, as well as the way that you believe that the material has to be kind of molded and developed yourself. And I think that that's listening, understanding, and being able to sort of host that party so that everybody goes away feeling like, they not only have they had a good time, but they've kind of brought to the party what they were hoping to. But also I think that's always in the service of the storytelling. you know, which, and I think that that way of being able to frame, angle, and focus every aspect of what you do into, is it the right way to tell the story? You know, constantly returning to that simple piece of interrogation. I think that skill, you could argue that skill in different permutations, or that skill is something that you never stop learning. You never stop kind of questioning whether you're sort of telling the story in quite the right way, whether it be, you know, sort of putting down a guitar break on a pop song in, you know, way back when, or whether it's, you know, whose point of view are we telling the story from in this particular scene, you know, right now. You know, I just wrapped on a show in France, you know, and this is the question that you keep on coming back to, you know, so that I think that sensitivity to the storytelling process, it's a transferable skill, it's a developing skill, it's a learning skill. And I think it's absolutely key to, you know, in different ways to each stage of the journey I've been on. Wow. Pick the bones out of that answer.
Actually, I loved it because one, while I was prepping for this, it did occur to me that everything that you do and have done is a form of storytelling as a musician, and also editing, which a lot of people overlook, is such a key part of visual storytelling. It also obviously is a key part of writing, because what we leave out and what we put in are both extremely important. But certainly in visual storytelling, how you choose to edit, what goes in, what goes out, but also what that shot is, the frame of it, all of it, that is such a powerful part of storytelling. And then obviously as a director. But the other thing that was a great segue for me that I thought I'd bring up later, but I'm going to ask you now, is in the spirit of collaboration and in the spirit of what's the best way to tell a story, what's it like, one, in the collaborative process? Because what I was getting at is, and especially for something like Doctor Who, which is so, I don't know, for lack of a better, iconic, entrenched in the culture, people have very strong opinions about Doctor Who. And so then you walk on a set and you have to bring your creative vision, but you're also, you know, in service to what already exists. And now also to the part where you, you know, just brought up the having to listen and keep hold space for what everybody else is bringing to the party. First of all, I want to know, what was it like for you? Like literally, like, you know, were your knees quaking, or were you like, damn it, this has like been on my bucket list since I was 5 years old? I mean, I have no idea. But also, how does that functionally work? Because I don't think most people know that when you come in, you're, you know, you're doing episodic and you may have multiple episodes, but still it's my point is, you're not working in a vacuum. It's not only your vision.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you know, you have to be in episodic television. And, you know, again, we come back to, you know, what's the clearest storytelling, I think. And I think, you know, it's a really good example that you pick, you know, the world of Doctor Who, because yes, you know, stepping into that world was, you know, simultaneously awe-inspiring and at the same time, you know, really, really, you know, excitingly challenging, you know, because, you know, so many great people have gone before you. And, you know, that, you know, since the regeneration of the show in the early 2000s, you know, so many superb episodes have been written, you know, that, you know, and you say that people have very, very strong and different opinions about Doctor Who. But, you know, for me, I think, you know, the showrunner, when I was working on the show, put it so well, you know, the thing that keeps Doctor Who going and the thing that keeps people coming back to Doctor Who in all its different regenerations, all its iterations, the thing that people come back to is that, you know, as Stephen Moffat said, we wrap it up in this kind of this package of sci-fi in order to sort of displace our real feelings. But actually beneath it, it is about human feelings and it is about human emotions. And it's about all the kind of fears, insecurities, and the demons that haunt us. And also trying to find our way through that. So it's you know, Doctor Who works so well because it's the story of life, you know, and it's even though it's always about aliens, it's fundamentally, it's about humans and about those human stories. And to sort of step into that, world. Yeah, it's exciting, it's terrifying, but it's also, you know, it's also you have to stop and think, wait a minute, I was that kid behind the sofa at five, you know, that was terrified by the Daleks, you know, and here I am working on this show. And that's, you know, that is really, really exciting. And for me, the first time I stepped onto the show, I have to say, I've always been completely in awe of Peter Capaldi, you know, who was the Doctor when I was working on the show. And for me, he was everything a Doctor should be. He was, you know, he was warm, engaging, he was thrilling, he was funny, he was, at times he was deep and dark. So you know, every layer of the, you know, the human psyche is there in his performance. And yeah, and that's exciting. And that's, you know, it's amazing to work with somebody, you know, that gifted and brilliant. At the same time, of course, you know, he's got an Oscar for a short film he directed, you know, so he's absolutely up, you know, in terms of the sort of consciousness of the project and the process, he is completely there in every which way, you know, and all the good people you work with are. But, you know, Peter was particularly brilliant. So you really felt the pressure of, you know, I really have to deliver. I have to, you know, but I think, again, you say to yourself, right, okay, we're doing a scene. What's important about this scene? Whose story are we, you know, whose point of view do I want to tell this scene through? What was it about this, you know, what was it in the script that told me we should shoot this in a, you know, from a certain point of view or whatever, you know, what are the fundamentals, what are the key points? And one other thing I've learned, which I'm not practicing now because I'm saying an awful lot of words, but you know, less is always more, you know. And the analogy that I stumbled upon completely blindly was, I was doing some sort of talk about directing in front of a live audience. And I just, it just struck me, that thing of when you drive out into the countryside and you get a bit lost. And obviously now we have GPS, we have our phones, we have Google Maps, whatever. In the, you know, back in the day, we'd stop, we'd wind down the window and we'd ask the first person we saw to help us get to where we're trying to go. The direction that, you know, when somebody just says, drive down that hill, turn left at the church, and the place you're looking for is half a mile on the left, you can't miss it, great, fantastic, thank you. The person that says, well, if you, this hill goes around a few bends and a few corners, and you'll see a lamppost on your left, and then there's Mrs. Hobson's house on the right, and then you go down another, there's a little curve and there's a big hedge, and you're lost. And it's that simple thing of, you know, simple, clear directions, you know, you need to say what needs to be said, but try and distill it into as few words as possible.
Wow. And do you find that across everything you've ever created?
And to be really, yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, it's about rehearsing your own performance and being conscious of, you know, always being conscious of, you know, how much you're asking people to absorb. And, you know, how clear and concise you're being, you know, all the time, you know. And it's, you know, make sure your own performance is at least vaguely coherent, you know. And I think that the way to, you know, with everything we do in life, you know, with what I'm trying to do now, all the time we're trying to edit. Everything we do is editing, you know. We're always trying to get to the essence. And, you know, we all have that really, really crushing thing where you take 2 minutes to explain something and somebody then says, oh, did you just mean open that door? You know what I mean? And it's like, yeah, that was kind of what I was saying. Yeah. You know, because it's like you might be in the sort of, you know, a stream of consciousness. You might be thinking, oh yeah, I'm really cooking in this moment. And then a minute later, somebody's like looking at you askance thinking, can you just get to the point? You know what I mean? And I think we learn to try and reduce, we learn to try and focus, we learn to try and kind of hit that spot of the answer to the question that is in the heads of the people that are around us, whether that's the audience or whether that's the people you're working with. You know, that it's that process of, you know, and again, it comes down to, you know, how do you offer up the clearest version of the storytelling?
Wow, I love this. One, I'm such an over-talker, so you're, you know, preaching to the choir. But two, I love the way you just addressed both things. One, the leadership component about being very clear on direction to everybody. This is what we're working on. This is why we're doing it. This is how we're going to do it. This is what you need to do. And then as well as the service of the actual storytelling of the project. That's amazing. And so I was just out of curiosity on a functional level. Again, it's like when you go into these shows, and so Doctor Who was well established, but like Poldark, you were the first director, you launched the show. So how does that work in collaboration? I mean, is there a style book? I have no idea, because I, you know, come from the unscripted world where it's like, if something, there might be a show Bible, but I don't know if there's an equivalent that says, this is our roadmap and go do it.
That's a really good question. You read the material and then you start to ask yourself, where am I going in my mind? For me, Poldark had this incredibly strong emotional pull to me because I've spent a huge part of my life about 30 miles from where that entire story is set, because my mother and father moved down to right on the edge of Devon, but they moved down to the Cornwall border just after the music finished back in the 80s, and I've been going down there ever since, and my kids grew up in that icy water, and they still love it, and they still, you know, they know all the beaches, they know all the places where you can get the best pasty, you know. But we also, that landscape, we've drenched our consciousness in that landscape as much as we've been drenched in the rain that landscape often draws to it. You know, it's part of us. And so I think for me, emotionally, it was a real gift. And the first thing that I thought about was the landscape and the way that the climate and the weather impact on people in that landscape. The weather shapes the consciousness, and the way the weather will take you in a direction. And of course, you know, we live in a very cosseted, comfortable world now, but you know, back in the 18th century, that would have impacted far more on people. So I started by thinking about the way, you know, the way that the landscape and the climate impact on people. And also there's something very sort of hard and unforgiving about that landscape. It's incredibly beautiful, but that took me in directions as well. And then you sort of start to ask yourself, okay, so we've got kind of the essence of, I can see that there's a direction where I could take the color palette here. And, you know, of course, do we want it to be like mud, gray, all horrible, you know, but probably not. But let's look at what else, you know, let's look at the flora in the landscape, you know. So, and they were really interesting. And along with it, of course, you're always working alongside people. And I had a brilliant production designer on that show. But, you know, our sort of initial sort of starting points for a color palette, which of course is a really key part of that initial lookbook, you know, a lot of it came from nature, a lot of it came from the landscape, and we build up from there. And then I can remember a sort of having an epiphany about, you know, the sort of the wide open skies of Cornwall, and just thinking of John Ford movies, you know, and making that connection, you know, and thinking of great Westerns like, you know, The Searchers, going back to you know, the images from that film and the references and the scenes and the way that they would kind of, you know, structure the way the audience would receive the landscape. I think it's funny because there are so many times when, you know, people say, what's your vision? And you kind of think, oh my God, what is my vision? I don't know. And then you have to sort of go away and really interrogate. And of course, you know, that is the whole point. A director has a vision. But what I'm saying is that I think that you know, finding that vision, arriving at it, it's an ongoing process. It's something you work at and you work at, and it's not something that kind of comes immediately. Someone told a great story about Ron Howard, you know, who's such a brilliant and such an established director. And they were really surprised because, you know, someone would say, why don't we do it this way? And they were all kind of like, God, is that the right thing to say? And he'd say, let's try it. You know, I think being humble is so important. And, you know, there will always be someone with a brilliant idea. And what you want to do is create the atmosphere, you know, not so that it becomes a free-for-all, of course, because it's discipline. And, you know, we've never got enough time and we've never got enough money. And whatever we do, that will always be the case. So we got to keep focused. You've got to keep disciplined. But at the same time, I want that atmosphere. I want that sort of sense of creativity on set, where if people do have an idea, you know, as I say, it's always good to hear that. I never forget a guy who's got his own documentary company in the UK now, and he was a runner when I was making a documentary. And it was something about the defense of Britain over the centuries. It was a documentary I loved. And he was talking about the ripple on the water as being a sort of visual metaphor for the sound waves. We were talking about the development of radar. And I just thought, that's a really good idea. You know, and that's, you know, it's the culture and the climate of creativity, which I think is really important for the director to nurture, that will become a really great tool in your toolkit.
Wow. Okay. So much there. So one, the beautiful visuals. So in my head, I had this incredible mood board, and it made me wonder if you actually create mood boards with your production designer, you know, not in addition to color palette, like, you know, the way, you know, clothing designers and big brands will have mood boards and what's the feel and the vibe. And also I'm really glad you brought up the reality of time and money. Cause I was going to say with all that, you know, vision, but nonetheless, the other big thing was the fact that you just addressed the kind of ripple effect of creativity as a transferable skill, because then the more that you're putting out there as a director, then everybody you're working with takes that with them to the next thing that they do. And that's a really sort of beautiful, positive, you know, have an impact on the world thing that you may not have considered, you know, the Basil Jet way. So bravo.
I wouldn't claim it myself, but I really think I've been so lucky because I've always had this let's try it mentality, you know, let's give it a go. I can remember when, you know, way back, and I'm not going to say what year it was, but I can remember a friend of mine in my hometown telling me that this band, The Vapors, were thinking of giving me a call about being their lead guitarist. And I'd seen this band, and they had this virtuoso guitarist who just, his fingers would be flying over the fretboard. He was brilliant. He was amazing. He was the best sort of heavy metal guitarist, you know, and his solos were so fast and so competent and so accomplished. And I can remember watching them thinking, yeah, he's a really good guitarist. And what a good band. And then I got this call saying, oh yeah, they're thinking of getting a new guitarist and they were considering you. And I was like, that's not me. But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, it would be a step up, but let's give it a go, you know? And I think that let's try it mentality, as I say, you know, you have to be disciplined. You have to be focused. You know, you can't let things run away with you, but at the same time, you know, yeah, let's try these things, you know?
Okay. So let's try these, and
who knows where it'll take you.
So let's try these things. You made a giant leap, which is not easy. Don't mean to put you on the spot, but going from unscripted to scripted is traditionally a very difficult thing. I mean, I can't speak for the UK, but in the US, people, you know, are very often boxed. Like, it's hard often to go from, you know, television journalism to print journalism, because print's like, but we're print and we write words. And I've even seen it on the casting side, where TV casting directors with multiple Emmys will be like, very, very hard to get into film, et cetera, et cetera. So you made this amazing transition, and you have an incredible portfolio. So I'm presuming it starts with a goal, like, I want to do this, or maybe you always want to do this. So I was curious, you know, did you meet with resistance, or what were the steps that you took? Were your agents like, yes, and now we're going to go do this? Or, you know, or did they say like, well, that's a nice dream, Ed, but it's very, very statistically difficult? Or how did you do it?
Well, number one, I didn't have an agent at the time because the unscripted world is not really sort of agentized in the UK. So that's the first thing. There was no one saying, oh, that's a tricky journey. There were people raising eyebrows. And I was, you know, at the time, at the beginning of the 2000s, I became a very established, you know, I was sort of fortunate to become an established documentary director within the BBC. Then there was this appetite for, you know, dramatizing sections of documentaries, and a couple of commissions that I went up for, you know, the producers were saying, and we want drama elements in it. And, you know, and it goes back to what I said before. It's like, okay, well, you know, I haven't done it, but maybe we should try, you know, let's try it. Let's see. And one film that was doing the rounds at the time was the BBC had commissioned a film on the life of Genghis Khan. And it was one of those really curious, funny moments of happenstance where I was actually being interviewed for something else, which didn't work out. And then literally 2 days later, the exec producer who'd been interviewing me rang me and said, "Didn't work out, sorry, mate. But how about going to Mongolia?" And I was like, "What? So I've just lost out on a job that was good and now you're asking me about a job that's amazing." And, you know, 4 months later, off I went to Mongolia, you know, with 110 cavalry horsemen from the Mongolian army, you know, telling the sort of origin story of Genghis Khan, you know, for a Western audience. And that show was, there is a point to this, that show, it came out of the BBC history department. It came out of a sort of documentary background. And there was narration, you know, we had a great actor to tell the story. But every scene was dramatized. And when we got to, I worked with a writer doing a kind of rough, you know, the first draft. And then when we got to Mongolia, you know, the casting directors were saying, well, we need some dialogue to, you know, because at first they were, I guess, like sort of more of a sort of silhouette-y type idea. And then suddenly in some hotel room in Ulaanbaatar, I had to start sort of bashing out all these dialogue scenes, you know, and bringing the whole thing to life. And of course, you know, it was, you know, exciting and hugely challenging and a little bit scary as well, you know, that you were trying to write these scenes for people and then they had to be translated, and you just hoped that not too much got lost in translation. But also I was being drawn more and more into the sort of storytelling, you know, into the sort of dramatic storytelling process. And, you know, I would be the first to say that, you know, writing those scenes was, the dialogue was probably dreadful, but again, you're trying to work those muscles that are there, but you just didn't know you had, you know, and you're trying to sort of exercise that storytelling discipline and function. And again, luckily the film, after a lot of months and months of painstaking work in the edit with a brilliant editor, we had a really, really great film on our hands, you know. And I never forget the next day that, you know, the controller of BBC One kind of sending out this really lovely email saying, "That's amazing, you got, I think it's 7 million viewers for on primetime BBC One on a Monday night, who came to a film which was all in Mongolian with subtitles, you know, unheard of." And, you know, that, and that was, you know, that those kind of, you know, obviously I've told it in quite a lot of detail because you don't forget those moments. But your question was, how do you make that shift? I guess as a compass fixing moment, I guess that was pointing me in a direction. But one of the things that I thought was really hit me hard then, and everybody does this in a different way. Everybody, you know, everybody I know who's transitioned, you know, most people have done it in a far smarter way than me. But one of the things I felt was, oh my goodness, you're just working so, how do you work at the speed that you have to work with when you're doing drama? And also the idea of a very, very strict, you know, very, very regimented schedule that was incredibly tight, always, you know, it never ceases to scare the living daylights out of me. And when you look at a schedule, you think, what? But one of the things that process taught me, it was really successful, but I think when you go out with a documentary camera team and the sound recordist, you get to that point where you think, oh my goodness, where we've still got to go and interview so-and-so and it's 6:30. Is it all right? I'm sure you can put in for the overtime. And, you know, four or five people make a, and have an understanding of if it's okay to do a little bit more on the end of the day. Of course, on a drama shoot, you just don't do that. You know, every moment has to be, every moment has to be sort of absolutely really kind of thoughtfully allocated, and you know, you can't just say, is it okay if we all do an extra hour tonight? You know, that just does not happen. You know, it certainly doesn't happen in the sort of UK world. And you know, as you work in different countries, you see some have a allowance for a certain amount of overtime, but in general, you know, the wrap time is the wrap time, and you don't go beyond that.
Yeah, you hit penalties that you're not going to hit in the teeny tiny run and gun crew. But if I'm synthesizing, one, you took amazing advantage. You seized an opportunity that came to you. Two, what I've heard consistently was the ability and the desire to say yes. When you presented with something, you're always saying yes, yes, and yes. And so it's, you know, sort of like the improv approach. And then finally, it was your ability to communicate your vision. I think if you're going to transfer creativity as a skill, part of it is about saying yes. And the other part is in everything you do, you communicate your vision, whatever that is. And so if anybody's listening who has like, I have all this stuff in my head and I see it and I feel it and I experience it, it is one thing that may be key to moving forward in anything you want to do is being able to get help other people to understand and see and feel what it is that you see and feel. And so whether that's through language or, you know, visuals is incredible. I think it's really incredible. I had also had one question too, is because you've had so much success in the historical side. I'm presuming it's a personal interest is history, but also how much does knowing history make a matter? Because I mean, you've spent a lot of time in Versailles from what I can tell, right? From Versailles to now just having worked on Marie Antoinette and, you know, a lot of dead kings all over the place. So how does that, because, and it's also one is like, you have this respect for the history, but also you have to contemporize the history and make it relevant to somebody watching now.
I think that's very true. It's a good point. I think in terms of contemporizing, I think that trying to find the resonances is essential. Why should people watch this story now? And you know, there will always be a really learned and a great textbook academic answer, which is, well, it's good for your TV. But you know, who wants to watch TV if it's just good for you? We want to be excited. We want to be horrified. We want to be entertained. But I do think you know the you know, the sort of the historic fiction zone is such a sort of potent area for storytelling, because of course, you know, there are always amazing stories out there that haven't been told. You know, in the case of Marie Antoinette, it's a story that's been told many, many times. But I think I would say for 95% of the people that who've heard that name, there must be squillions of people across the globe, they will tend to have one very, very reductive narrative, you know, that they've been presented with, that, you know, throughout their lives. And what we're attempting to do in this story is to scratch beneath the surface, peel back the layers, and you know, was she the creature that the historic snapshot has sort of has designated, you know, and given to her, and let's find out more about this person. And I think that way that, you know, historical drama, historic fiction, and storytelling has people, it's this wonderful habit that's developed of, it sends people online as soon as they finish watching. You know, did that happen? Did that, what was going on?
Oh, there? I'm guilty, you know, of checking, you know, while I'm watching.
Which is, I think that means we're doing our job. We're telling the story in a way that's engaging people to want to know more. But again, it's not just about accumulating knowledge. It's about, you know, it's about getting into these characters. And that, I think, is, you know, such a fundamental part of what we do as dramatists.
Wait, what surprised you about Marie Antoinette?
That's a very, very sharp, direct question. I liked how she hated the formality of court life. I liked how she, for example, we've got a moment where in one of my episodes, it's not too much of a spoiler, but she's breastfeeding. She, you know, everybody had wet nurses. She wanted to breastfeed.
Wow.
You know, there are ways in which she was a very different person, but you know, at the same time, I wouldn't run away with wanting to say, you know, what a sort of icon of, you know, sort of progressive, forward thinking, you know, mindset she was. But also I think the other thing that does surprise me, and I'm still trying to come to terms with it, and still delving into the history, and even afterwards, which is again, I think it's a good sign, but even after the whole process of filming it, I want to read more. I want to know more, because I think the thing that doesn't surprise me so much as shock me about how these people, obviously they made the wrong moves. They did the wrong things, you know, on one level, but at the same time, how powerless they were in the face of the broad sweep and the thrust of history and the way that the world was changing at that time. And, you know, and these kids, they were kids, you know, they didn't stand a chance. And, and I think that's a really shocking story. But again, you know, it comes back again, you know, in the British royal family, you know, when you look at the latest series of The Crown and the story of Diana, you know, people that had a gilded cage existence from day one, but at the same time, you know, there is, beneath all that, you know, for better or for worse, there's a human being there, you know, and I think I wouldn't want to push that sort of analogy between Marie Antoinette and Diana too hard or too far, but I think at the same time, you know, it's interesting when you get down to the simple human level.
Okay, so one final question. So who is a historical figure that you would love to tell the story of that you feel like their story hasn't been told?
That's an interesting one. I would, from a very, not a person, but from a very, very subjective point of view, I would love to tell this. I think I can remember one director saying there's a war story in all of us. I would love to tell a really good kind of chewy, difficult story about pacifism. So that's not a historic figure, but there would be many, many people that could be chosen, because I think that's a voice of people for whatever reason, they set off on that journey to stand against stand against the tide and to say, no, I won't do this. I think those stories are compelling and really important.
Mm-hmm.
I would also, you asked me for a name, I would love to tell the story of Angie Duke Biddle, who was a tobacco heir, who was Kennedy's head of protocol and then was ambassador to Spain in the mid-1960s at the time of the Palomares incident, which I think is one of the great untold stories of the Cold War. And it's been a passion project of mine for years. And it will probably never see the light of day, but it's just such a great story. And he is such a compelling character in the sort of heart of a group of people who are, you know, on the tip of southern Spain in the mid-60s, four H-bombs fall out of the sky, and suddenly this tomato-growing remote region of Spain is rained on by the whole industrial military complex of the United States. And that coming together of an extraordinary circumstance in the middle of this very, 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 very out-of-the-way community, I think is a wonderful story and one I'd love to tell one day. And if you know anyone who wants to commission it, then okay, you got your guy.
We're putting it out to the universe. And I got to end it there because now I got to go Google this.
And good luck.
It's a story that needs to be told. Thank you. I really thank you. This has been so fun. And I can't believe I hope we don't have to wait another 40 years because I probably won't be here in the next 40 to talk to you.
I definitely intend not to be. Yeah. No, it's been an absolute pleasure. I know I was so bad at self-editing. I never said that I went from big drama documentaries to then I thought, okay, learn the drama schedule, go and do soap. And that's what I did. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made. And I think that was the foundation of everything that followed. Mm. There you go, concise. You can chuck that in wherever you want.
Oh, I heart you so much. And I want to thank you for listening to Camera Ready and Able. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star rating. It's much appreciated and it really does help. And if you want to feel more confident and experience more joy and success in your work and life, please shoot me a note via my website, ableintermedia.com, and be sure to download my free ebook, 12 Tips for Success on Camera.